Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. This week, I'm bringing you what I think is a really excellent interview with Dr. Marion Nessel. Marion Nessel is Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, which she chaired from 1988 to 2003. She also holds appointments as Professor of Sociology at NYU and Visiting Professor of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell. Her degrees include a PhD in molecular biology and an MPH in public health nutrition, both from the University of California, Berkeley. She has held faculty positions at Brandeis University and the UCSF School of Medicine. From 1986 to 88, she was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and Managing Editor of the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. Her research examines scientific, economic, and social influences on food choice. She is the author of three prize-winning books, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, Safe Food, Bacteria, Biotechnology, and Bioterrorism, and What to Eat. Her latest book, Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine, was published in September 2008. She writes the Food Mattered column for the San Francisco Chronicle and blogs at www.foodpolitics.com. Dr. Nessel, in your books, Food Politics and What to Eat, one of the threads that comes through very clearly is that you have a behind-the-scenes look at the money and the politics of the food industry, both on its regulatory end and on its production end, that is unparalleled in my experience. So how did you get involved in the politics of food?
Oh, that's actually a very easy question to answer. It began in the early 1990s, after I'd worked in Washington for a couple of years, which was an education in itself. I was invited to a meeting in Washington by the former Surgeon General Everett Koop, who had a meeting at the National Cancer Institute that was focused on behavioral causes of illness, of chronic disease. And the two behaviors he was interested in were smoking and diet. And I had never heard the anti-smoking medical community talk before. I certainly knew that smoking was bad, and I didn't smoke myself. And I knew that everybody was stopping smoking. But I had never heard anyone talk about cigarette marketing in quite the way that these people did. One after another of them showed incredible slide collections, photographs of cigarette marketing in remote areas of the world, the jungles of Africa, the remote villages in the Himalayas. Then one of them gave a talk on food marketing to children, in which he showed pictures of Joe Camel, which was very popular at the time, close to schools, at music events, at sporting events, at all places where kids would be. And when I was finished watching these, I turned to the other person who was speaking about food, who happened to be Jane Brody, and said, you know, I think we should be doing this for Coca-Cola. And it was a revelation to me. It wasn't that I had never noticed cigarette marketing before. I had just never noticed so much of it, or how pervasive it was, or how absolutely deliberately intentional it was in that way. And so I began noticing how food companies marketed junk foods, particularly to kids. And when I had a sabbatical, I began writing a few articles about it. I wrote an article about soft drink marketing in schools. I wrote one about marketing to children. I wrote one about the history of the Department of Agriculture pyramid and about the history of dietary guidelines, in which I talked about food company involvement in those events, and I had a sabbatical coming up, and I thought I would just take those articles and put them together in a book and call it Food Politics, and of course it got completely out of hand.
These projects usually do.
As they do. It ended up as two books. It ended up as Food Politics, and then the material on food safety and food biotechnology ended up as a second book the following year, Safe Food. And then Food Politics has been revised in a new edition in 2007, and I'm currently revising Safe Food.
One of the points you make in What to Eat, which is the most recent book, I believe.
No, actually the most recent book is Pet Food Politics.
Pet Food Politics.
Which is a book about the melamine pet food recalls of 2007, which I wrote as an example of the problems in our food safety system. I thought it was one of the best examples I've ever seen about why our food safety system needed a fix.
Well, I'm going to jump right into that. We're going to just do a free form here and depart from notes, which is always the best way. And let's talk about the issue of the widely distributed food network, and particularly the sourcing from China. One of my chief concerns is I use a lot of nutritional substances in my practice, even though I'm a primary care, conventionally medical trained doctor. I'm also a self-taught naturopath at this point in my life. And I worry a lot about the purity of the compounds that...
Well, you should.
Yes, I know I should. And the melamine is just one example. The other one that comes to mind is the heparin issue.
Yes, which occurred right after the pet food recalls. And my point about the pet food recalls was that if we didn't fix the food safety system for pets, humans were going to be in trouble. And of course, immediately after, the heparin business came up, which is exactly the same story. And then following that, melamine ended up in infant formula in China, and 300,000 babies were affected by it.
And while it's no surprise, I'm making a trip to China in about 6 weeks, and I'm feeling extremely nervous about eating anything. I know that's an exaggerated emotional response, but at the same time, I can't quite...
My advice would be to make sure it's well cooked.
Okay. Will that vaporize melamine?
I don't know if that'll do anything about melamine, but it'll at least kill the bacteria.
Okay. There's lots of things that we could go into from this point, but let's talk about some prescriptive things. What do we need to be asking our government, or demanding? Let me rephrase that. We don't have to ask. We're the people. We can tell them. What do we need to tell them to do, and how can we economically, feasibly do it?
Well, if you're talking about food safety, we need a food safety system. We don't now have one.
And what would that system look like?
Well, let me say what we have now first,
all right.
Which is a piecemeal system divided between two agencies with many gaps and overlaps that requires science-based food safety production procedures for only a handful of foods, meat and poultry on the USDA side, and on the FDA side, only seafood and sprouts. Everything else is produced under good manufacturing practices that are, for all intents and purposes, voluntary. For starters, we don't have a food safety system. We need one, I think, under a single food safety agency that requires science-based food safety procedures for every food producer from farm to table. Now, as for how much it will cost, I visited the Earthbound Farms plant in San Benito County that was involved in the spinach recalls of 2006. And they have instituted science-based food safety procedures that involve testing, amongst other things. I mean, it's just an astonishing production procedure. It's absolutely state-of-the-art. You think it would be a standard for the entire industry. And when I asked them how much it cost them to do it, they said it was a penny a case because their volume is so great. We can afford it.
A penny a case. We can definitely afford that.
Yeah, I mean, the reverse question, it seems to me, is a much more important one. How can we afford not to?
Well, once we actually have the government paying for all the cases of salmonella that go into the hospital due to bad poultry management or the problems with egg production, maybe we will. But we don't have a closed loop right now. And I'm an ecological thinker, and until the people who are spending the money are spending it at both ends, you know, for the consequences of not doing the inspection versus just saving money by not doing the inspection, it's hard to imagine
that you can get that to happen on a straight economic argument.
Well, I think what everybody needs to understand is this is Congress. This isn't the FDA or the USDA. This is Congress. Congress tells the FDA what to do and enables the FDA to do the right thing if the FDA is inclined to do the right thing. Right now, you know, for the last umpteen years, Congress has blocked everything that the FDA wanted to do. That looks like it's changing, and I think that's a very hopeful sign. But for the public, this is deal with your congressional representative. I don't understand. I mean, I do understand, but I don't think there's nearly enough outrage about food safety issues. I mean, people feel like it's, you know, not that important. It doesn't bother them that much unless they happen to get sick or unless they know somebody who's really been hit by something toxic. And I've often said that the only thing that's ever going to get Congress to move on this is for some very senior senator to have some member of his family get sick from food poisoning, and then maybe we'll get some action.
I have seen statistics that say that every American probably gets sick from contaminated food at least once a year.
And no, it's 76 million is the figure that's bandied about by the Centers for Disease Control. I mean, the sort of standard figures are 76 million cases of food poisoning a year, 325,000 hospitalizations, and 5,000 deaths.
How did they count that 76 million?
There's a paper that was published, I don't know, about 10 years ago that went through
was
all of that.
Doctor's office visits?
I mean, you know it's an underestimate because nobody reports these things unless they're really, really sick.
Well, you would not believe how many people come in and say, well, I had stomach flu last week. What's stomach flu? Well, stomach flu is where you get really sick and you vomit and then you have diarrhea and you feel like crap for a day. No, that's not viral. That's food poisoning.
Yeah, it's likely to be food poisoning, so it's probably underestimated. But, you know, you really have no way of knowing whether those figures have any kind of relationship to reality. But whether they're a lot or a little depends on whether you're optimistic or pessimistic. I mean, there are 350 million people in America. They eat at least three times a day, 365 days a year. That's a lot of eating occasions. I think it's amazing that it's not worse.
So we've established that we don't have a safe food supply. And I presume the reason we don't have a good food supply is that there's some countervailing force that's getting in the way of what would otherwise be sensible government behavior. Could I hazard a guess that it might be the interests of the large industrial food chain and its lobbyists that...
Well, that's not a bad guess. I mean, food companies don't want to have to do anything that is going to cost them money because their goal is to sell as much cheap food as possible, as cheaply as possible. First of all, it requires some intelligence. You have to design those systems so they work. And then you have to be really diligent and faithful and really have it matter to you. And I think that food companies won't do that without government regulation. And my evidence for that is, let's pick a random example. How about peanut butter, for example? I mean, here's a company that was producing peanut butter that they knew was contaminated with salmonella. And they didn't like the lab results they got, so they went to another lab until they got the results they wanted. You know, unless you've got some sort of government inspection or somebody minding the store on those things and holding these companies accountable, they're going to cut every corner they can, regardless of how many people get sick or die.
It's a frightening thought. You make the point in your book, What to Eat, that we have an excess of production calories in this country, an estimate of 3,900 kilocalories per capita. And this leaves the food industries with basically three choices. They can either make less food and charge more for it, or they can persuade the consumer to buy my brand of food, or they can persuade the consumer to eat more. In general, those second two choices tend to be the ones that have been taken by the industry. With respect to the safety issues, there's not been much marketing by the industry on the subject of safety practices. In the naturopathic world, we have a lot of companies that emphasize that as this is what makes our different is we triple check everything, or we have independent inspections of all our products, or we check for bioavailability. And perhaps that's just because they're playing to a more sophisticated audience. But have you ever seen a food company try to sell on the basis of safety?
Oh, yes, and very successfully. During and after the pet food recalls, some pet food companies took their safety responsibilities very seriously and insisted that their suppliers provide test results, and they posted those test results on the web where their customers could see them. I thought this set a standard for how to deal with the public in a transparent way, and it worked very much to their advantage. And I think lots of food companies could do that. I would like to know that food is being produced under standard science-based food safety plans that unfortunately have an awful name, HACCP. But, you know, I want to know that the foods that I'm eating are produced under HACCP plans and that somebody is paying attention to this. Not that the system would be perfect. I don't think you can ever guarantee that food will be 100% safe. But we could do a lot better than we're now doing.
I'd like to take the two of us, and you're going to be the native guide in this, and I'm the tour leader, and we have our audience. And let's go on a supermarket safari. Let's go into that large food store with perhaps 40,000 different products is the number that you quote for a typical average supermarket. And let's explore it from an anthropological standpoint, maybe looking at why things are laid out the way they are. I think you do a brilliant job of that in What to Eat, and I'd like to share some of that information with the audience.
Oh, thank you. Actually, it was the first revelation when I started to write What to Eat. And I should say that What to Eat is not really a book about what to eat. It's a book about how to think about what to eat. And I used supermarkets as an organizing principle and then just went through the supermarket aisle by aisle, trying to answer every question that I could possibly think of or that I thought anybody would want to know about the products in that supermarket. And the first thing that I learned was that supermarkets are not social service agencies, even though they perform an enormous societal function in giving you one-stop shopping, and sometimes really good one-stop shopping. They're there to make money. I don't know why it had never dawned on me that that was their primary purpose, but there it was. And I learned very quickly that there's a reason why you can go into any supermarket in America, or for that matter, throughout the world, and they're all organized in exactly the same way. They're organized in the same way because that's what sells the most food. So you always go in and find the produce section or flowers when you come in, because that kind of sets the tone. You think you're in southern Italy or some outdoor market in Provence or something like that. And then the uncooked foods, the real foods, are kind of around the periphery, and the processed foods are all in the center aisles. The overriding guiding principle of supermarkets is the more products that people see, the more they will buy. So the entire purpose of a supermarket is to get you to look at as many products as possible. And everything about the supermarket is set up to get you to look at products. And then the ones that are most profitable are at eye level, about 60 inches off the floor. Or they're at the cash registers or at the end of the aisles, what are called the end caps. And if you go through a supermarket and sort of look at that, that's the first thing you notice, is that nothing is there in an accidental position. Everything is where it is for a purpose. The lighting has a purpose. The floor design has a purpose. The length of the aisles has a purpose. And if there's a bakery or a special counters or somebody doing cooking demonstrations, they have a purpose too. And the purpose, of course, is to get you to buy more food, not less. So if you go into a supermarket with a shopping list and come out with three times as many items as were on your list, you are doing exactly as predicted.
And I think we're all nodding our heads about that one. Oh, yes, I could use that. Or, oh, that might be interesting to try.
Oh, that'll be fun. Let's do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Exactly. Well, along with the layout being highly researched, there's some interesting principles along the length of the aisles. I thought that was interesting. How long does the aisle have to get before people start to complain?
Well, I don't know the exact number of feet, but it's pretty well calculated. And 120 feet, I'm guessing, is about as long as they can get. Although there is one supermarket chain in the Northeast where there's only one aisle. It's Stu Leonard's. And you go into it, and there's only one aisle, and it twists and turns around kind of like a maze, and you come out the other end at the cash register. But the store is set up with so many entertaining things in it and so many fun things to do that people don't even notice. But once you're in it, you can't get out of it very easily.
It's a labyrinth.
Yeah, it's very clever.
And labyrinths induce a meditational state.
Well, yes.
And, and you're meditating on all the wonderful things that you should be purchasing.
That you should be buying
here.
And putting into your shopping cart. But that's only part of the entire environment of food choice, which is totally set up to get people to eat more foods, not less. And I, of course, relate food marketing very closely to obesity. I mean, to go back to your original question, why did I do this? One of the things that I was very tired of was going to meetings about childhood obesity and never hearing a word about food marketing, as if food marketing had nothing whatsoever to do with it. And I'm happy to say that that has changed a lot. Now everyone is talking about food marketing, and talking particularly food marketing to children, and I think that's a really big change and one that I'm very happy has occurred.
One of the things that I find on that subject most shocking was a change that happened after I'd left school, so it was under my radar until it was brought to my attention. But somewhere along the way, I guess in the 90s, these large soft drink companies started paying schools to let them feed dessert, basically, which is what soda is, and I totally agree with that premise in your book, to let children eat dessert all day. And furthermore, children would even have soft drinks in the classroom, which amazed me to no end. When did that start? Am I right that it was the early 90s?
No, it was the late 90s. So it started in the early 90s at the college level. I think Rutgers was the first university to develop a pouring rights contract with a soft drink company. But by the late 90s, it had gone down actually to the grammar school level, but was very common in high schools and junior high schools. And schools were competing to get these contracts because it looked like they were going to get so much money out of them just at the time when school district budgets were going down. So school principals were among the people who were most interested in getting these contracts. The contracts themselves were designed to put as many vending machines into schools as could possibly be put into them. And the reason for that is that there's research that shows that the more vending machines there are, the more products will be bought from them. So the idea was to create an environment in which it became socially acceptable to get things out of vending machines all the time. And so then the kids were drinking soft drinks all day long, and nobody really thought very much about the health implications. The people who were running the school said, well, they're going to drink soft drinks anyway. Why don't we get the money for it instead of somebody else getting the money? But then it soon became obvious what had happened, which is that the soft drink companies make much more money out of this than the school districts do. And there was then a backlash. But a lot of schools still have them.
A lot of schools still do. The idea that the drink itself, the substance that's being sold in these soda bottles, is actually the least expensive aspect of selling this product is something I find fascinating. And you make a point in What to Eat about Pepsi and different serving sizes and cost per ounce. The intriguing thing about it is that smaller containers containing less actually work out to cost much more. Can you speak to that a little
sure.
bit?
Sure. I mean, there's an economy of scale there. But the part that I love about it the most, I speak a lot to food industry executives, and I once complained to supermarket executives about the way in which the pricing was on the 2-liter soft drinks and on the 8-ounce cans, and how much cheaper it was to buy the 2-liter soft drinks. The bigger the quantity, the more calories it has, and the more people will eat of it, and so forth and so on. It's a calorie promoter.
Here's the table. I found it. It's 71 cents per quart for the 2-liter bottle, and $1.50 per quart if you buy that in 8-ounce cans.
Yeah, that's a big difference. That's a big difference. And the research shows that people eat what's in the container. If it's a bigger container, they'll eat more. And not only that, but it has more calories, and people will underestimate the number of calories they've eaten by a much greater extent from a larger serving than they will from a smaller serving. all soft drinks are sugars of one kind or another, usually high fructose corn syrup, which is very cheap, and water. And you can sell it for whatever those prices are these days. But they're very, very profitable items. But these food industry executives said, well, if people want smaller portions, they ought to be willing to pay for them. I mean, that was their view of it. I mean, for them, it was a perfectly simple thing. So, again, the purpose of...
Wait. I'm having trouble with
this. If you're a food company executive, your job is to sell more food, not less.
So I need to pay for the privilege of eating less of your product?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's twisted.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is because of farm subsidies that make the cost of basic food ingredients very low. So the cost of the packaging, the marketing, the labor, everything that goes with it is much greater than the actual cost of the food. So you can make a larger portion and charge a little bit more for it and make a nice, tidy profit off of that. And that's what people do. So I'm very sympathetic in some ways to what food companies are going through. Because as I mentioned, as you mentioned, very nicely actually, the number of calories available per capita in the food supply is 3,900 a day. And that's for every man, woman, and child in the country. And it includes what's produced in the country, less exports plus imports. So the 3,900 calories is roughly twice what the average need is of the population as a whole. So if you're a food company and you're trying to sell food in a situation in which there's twice as much food available, you've got a lot of work to do. That's going to be a hard sell. So you try to do everything that you can in order to sell your product, to push your product in those circumstances. And then, as if that weren't hard enough, you've got Wall Street breathing down your neck. If you're a publicly traded company, you have to report growth to Wall Street every 90 days. So it's not enough that you're selling a product and making a profit. You've got to increase that profit every 90 days.
We need more.
Or Wall Street gets very upset with you. And your stock prices go down and everybody gets angry. And so these companies are desperate to find ways to sell more food. And it's not that they're trying to make people fat, or that they're conspiring to turn Americans into, you know, an obese population. They're conspiring to sell more food because a normal part of doing business.
They're basically like any entity, and you have to think of these corporations as if they were animals competing for survival and trying to stay alive. And the framework of the game, or the selective pressures of their environment, of their evolutionary environment, is the selective pressure of growth and dividend. An animal, you know, gets to the point of reproduction and then actually stops growing and puts that energy into the offspring, basically, so that the population can grow. So in an interesting way, the imperatives growth exists and are reproduced almost fractally across various complex systems. This one, however, is one where we have to be careful about the consequences. On page 319 of your book, What to Eat, you start talking about sugar, and there's a fascinating on-topic comment that in 1980, there were 30 gallons of soda consumed, presumably made and consumed, since soda lasts forever, per capita in the United States. And in 2003, that had gone to 35 gallons. And I just ran some numbers, and it works out, if you actually run the numbers on that, that it works out to an extra 16,000 calories a year, which, if you do the math, is 5 pounds a year. So right there, just in the increase in soda production and presumably consumption, we have 5 pounds a year per capita. And I don't know if you did the math on your own statistics, but I found that an astonishing number.
Yeah, that's an astonishing number. And I wish it was as simple as that, but that's a rough approximation of how the system works. I think the body compensates for small differences in calories so that it doesn't add up that way. But what people tell me, what pediatricians, for example, tell me, is that it's not that people who are overweight are consuming one soda a day extra. They're consuming thousands of calories a day extra from sodas, 1,000, 2,000 calories a day. They think that they find that quite common in their practices, to see kids, for example, who are overweight, who are drinking 5, 10, 20-ounce sodas a day. They're just sipping them all day long.
That's their fluid source.
Oh, they have food on top of that, which is why they're gaining weight.
Yes.
And the body can't compensate for that. It's just really not possible.
There are a profusion of new, quote-unquote, healthy soft drinks. I'm starting to see, I think they've got Pepsi fortified with something or other. I think it's calcium. And there are also these things called vitamin waters that essentially water, sugar, and a few drops of folate. And many of the so-called juice drinks that I think that's a particularly insidious one because parents buy that thinking that they're buying something healthy for their kids that's not bad for them, like soda. So I'd like you to speak to those points.
Well, indeed. I mean, these are these new functional foods that marketers or that food marketers are doing because they sell. People look at them and they have this health aura, and everybody forgets about the calories because they have nutrients in them or because they have something taken out. Or my favorite example these days is a juice drink for children that is advertised as improving kids' brain development and immune function because it's got DHA in one of them and some vitamins and minerals in another. And it's a juice drink, a sweetened juice drink. It's not even juice. It's a juice drink. That, I think, you know, for uncritical parents who aren't really thinking about these things, they just look at it and think, gee, this must be healthy. If I feed my kid this sugary drink, my kid's going to be smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that sort of thing really frightens me because they already have such marketing behind them, and to make people feel that they're actually doing something healthy. I mean, the only thing I had going for me in the fight against soda before was the, it's bad for you, it'll rot your teeth, it's bad for you. Now, if they take that away from me, I don't know what weapon I have.
Well, indeed. You know, but this also has a lot to do with regulation because, you know, if it were up to me, I would take the vending machines out of schools and I would take all health messages off of food. Food is food, drugs are drugs. I'd try to keep them separate, but unfortunately, nobody asked me.
One of my favorite authors on the topic of food is Michael Pollan, and he calls these things food-like substances.
Food-like objects, yes.
Yes. And if, you know, a food-like substance is something that comes in a box and with a health claim on the label. And if it has a health claim on the label, it is, by definition, to be viewed with suspicion because, for one thing, it has a label. And for another, most of the things that are truly healthy for you don't have lobbies that will get permission from Congress and the FDA to put a health claim on their label, should they have a label.
Well, they may have lobbies, but their lobbyists aren't paid nearly as well. And, you know, one of the great puzzles is why the fruit and vegetable people can't get their act together. And use
Why is that?
They can't because they view each other as competitors. They don't view each other as a part of some unified, you know, meat is meat, beef is beef, milk is milk, but cauliflower and broccoli are not the same thing, and carrots and peaches and apples. They all view each other as competitors, and they don't make as much money as the big commodity producers are, so they don't have as much money to use the political process as well as some of these corporations. And so this is another one of my recommendations, which is that we do something about federal campaign laws, which I see as the root of the corruption in our government. If our elected officials were elected, not because of corporate money, but because they really represented a point of view, then we might be able to elect some officials who are interested in public health more than they were in corporate health.
Right on. I want to come back to high fructose corn syrup because that is it's not a food really because it's an invented combination and it's become so widespread. And I know in your book, What to Eat, you don't really see there as being a real problem with high fructose corn syrup.
Oh, I think there's a problem. I just don't think it's any different from table sugar.
I would actually differ with you a little bit on that. And the reason I do is, in fact, you explained to me why. I've always felt that there was a difference and certainly seen biological data suggesting that there is some difference in terms of which feedback loops, in terms of satiety loops, are being kicked off.
Yeah, but that's fructose versus glucose, and the amount of fructose and glucose in corn syrup is the same as that in sucrose.
But sucrose is a dimer, And when you look at those sugars in the high fructose corn syrup...
Yeah, but the dimer is separated in your mouth, practically.
Some of it's in your mouth and some of it's in your stomach. And I'm wondering, though, if the act of separating those couldn't have, just by the virtue of absorption across the mucous membranes, some sort of feedback loop effect. In any event, there is a difference physiologically in how your body handles fructose and glucose and how where it fits into Krebs cycle. And
yeah, that there's no question.
And
about.
So when you change the balance of those things, I think sucrose is arguably less bad for you than high fructose corn syrup, but I don't think either of them are good for you.
Well, I think all these soft drink companies that are putting sucrose back into their soft drinks are going to use that argument exactly. You think a soft drink with sucrose in it is a better bet than one with high fructose corn syrup?
Let's debate that for a moment, because I think there might be a difference in the satiety. That's what I'm worried about with the high fructose corn syrup is I remember, I'm old, and I remember when the sodas changed and I was still drinking soda. And the kosher Coca-Cola, if you get that, you know, around Passover, that's made with sucrose. And you compare it to an equal amount of the, do the test yourself. I urge my audience.
Well, they certainly taste better.
They taste better, but I've always found that the sucrose sodas spoil my appetite better, too, or worse. I mean, I am less able to eat anything after having had one. And I get more of a satiety reaction. In other words, remember your mom used to always say, you know, don't drink that now, it'll spoil your dinner. And you went ahead and drank it, and lo and behold, it spoiled your supper because you just weren't hungry. And I think the satiety feedback loop is different. And that is, that's hard to test, but there's a subjective quality. And I'd be interested in just challenging the audience who's listening to this to get a hold of kosher Coke and regular Coke and take 8 ounces before, you know, half an hour before dinner and see if you think it spoils your supper. I'd be interested in your feedback.
Yeah, it would be interesting to hear that. I'd like to know that too.
Well, we'll see how many people respond and I'll pass along the emails. Why are there so much more corn sweeteners? There's definitely got to be some politics behind that one.
Oh yeah, that one's easy too. It's because corn is subsidized. Corn is one of the commodity crops that the federal government subsidizes. And this is another really interesting political issue. When I first got interested in nutrition in the mid-1970s, there were already enormous fusses about subsidies of certain agricultural crops. And every single administration that has come into power in the intervening 30 years has tried to get rid of subsidies, and they just can't do it. And that has to do with our election campaign laws again, because they can't afford to lose the Iowa vote or one of those other Midwestern states that grows corn and soybeans and so forth. Everybody knows the system doesn't work. Everybody knows the system is counterproductive, and no administration has ever been able to do a thing about it. It'll be interesting to see whether the current one can.
It will be interesting. I think we're pinning so many hopes on the current administration that I think we're setting ourselves up to be disappointed. I want to quote something. This was written in 1942, and we'll leave sugar behind after this. I loved it. In 1942, the AMA put out a comment, and they sounded an alarm because there had been an 11-fold increase in sugar in the American diet since 1821. And it had gotten up to 108 pounds per capita per year, which is now, of course, 60% of what we currently have. They were especially concerned about the rapid increase in the per capita supply of soft drinks that was up to 3 6-ounce bottles per week. And I'm looking at this 35 gallons per year, and I'm just, you know, wondering about the ghosts of these old doctors rolling around, you know, waving their fingers.
And I never drink the stuff, so you must be having twice as much.
Exactly. Well, somebody's having mine as well. I want to come back to our supermarket safari for a moment and talk about an interesting concept, one I hadn't heard before, but I think it is really critical because as the food marketers respond to our attempts to be healthy, and certainly that's one of the things my show is all about, is trying to give people good advice about how to be healthy. They're doing things like flying blueberries in from Paraguay in November so that you can buy fresh blueberries. And so I'd like you to talk both from an ecological perspective, if you will, and also from a value perspective is the food nutritionally valuable, about this concept of food miles.
Ah, yes, food miles. Very controversial these days. I think it's very difficult to tell what the ecological impact of local versus conventional food is, because it depends on what assumptions you use, and lots of people have waded in on this issue, and they come out with very different kinds of results. But I like to look at it in a different way. I think locally grown food tastes better, it's fresher, there's no question about that. And I love the idea of supporting local farmers. And I like knowing my farmer, I like chatting with the people at farmers markets, and I like the idea that there are farms in the area in which I live. That's a value system judgment. When it comes to blueberries in December, which in New York come from Chile or Argentina or Tierra del Fuego sometimes, it's kind of fun, I have complicated feelings about it. Sometimes I like to have those things, and I think, well, I'm helping farmers in those countries. I mean, I think one of the things about a global food system is that you can get things off-season that you can't grow in the area in which you are. And so I'm not a purist about seasonal and local. I just try to buy as much local food as I possibly can and use the rest as luxuries.
Okay. On the subject of the sort of decline in nutrients, because the longer a food sits off of the vine, the more its nutritional content deteriorates. I mean, we can see that. You talk about the wilted, quote-unquote, fresh broccoli that's obviously taken a week to get to you as opposed
to
the 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
As opposed to being at that conference in Salinas and snipping a piece of broccoli off of the box that had been cut that morning. And we're all very, very aware of those differences in freshness in food.
Oh, yes. You people in California have no idea how lucky you are.
Oh, we do. Believe me, we do. We travel. And we go through serious withdrawal, I might add. I just got back from Florida, but that's another story. The thing about the deterioration is I'm often looking at my mega market, you know, mega buyers club blueberries, and I'm thinking, okay, am I better off with the frozen blueberries that are sitting in my refrigerator that are perhaps not as tasty as these fresh ones, but in terms of their nutritional content, am I better off with stuff that's frozen right away, flash frozen, or something that may have taken 2 weeks to get to where it's sitting?
Well, I think there's three different issues in that. I don't think there's any question that fresh foods taste better than frozen. But if you can't get fresh vegetables in winter, and I live in New York, we don't have fresh vegetables in winter, then the frozen ones are just fine, especially the ones that have one ingredient on the package, peas, beans, corn, whatever. The loss in nutritional value, you know, it's hard to know unless you're testing how serious a problem that is. The most labile vitamin is vitamin C. And if you're eating any fresh fruits or vegetables at all, you're going to be getting the vitamin C that you need. So you're always making a trade-off in taste, flavor, cost, and these other kinds of issues. And if you think about it too hard, you could go crazy.
What about the carbon footprint? I'm just curious, do you think there's a difference in carbon footprint between the blueberries from Argentina and the frozen organic blueberries that I buy? I mean, we worry about carbon footprint in my part of California, so.
No, we do worry about it, and that's what I was talking about before. I don't understand the assumptions that go into these things, and I find that the analyses that I've read of carbon footprint all are based on different assumptions. And so you can organize the assumptions to give you the answer that you want on whether something is better or worse. I'm waiting for some agreement on that.
Okay.
I think the research isn't in. You know, as I said, my great preference is for locally grown foods, not only for the taste and flavor, but also because of the community building aspects of it, which I like very much.
Good answer. So even though we have a lot of milk production, short of California Raisins, which had to be my all-time favorite food ad campaign, the milk mustache has definitely become a cultural icon at a level that people who advertise food must just have wet dreams about being able to come up with something that grabs the cultural zeitgeist to that degree. So milk mustache aside, milk politics and the perverse incentives behind milk production are something we should address. And I particularly want to talk about the recombinant bovine somatotropin and the issues around how that might affect humans, because they always tell us, oh, no, it gets dissolved in the stomach. But there's more to the story than that, so I wish you'd tell us about it.
There is more to the story than that, and I wish I had a better grasp on where the research stands and whether we really understand it very well. It's pretty clear that the recombinant bovine somatotropin, or cow growth hormone, that's fed to cows to get them to produce more milk, it's pretty clear that it doesn't act as a growth hormone in humans because it has a different amino acid composition, and it's not the same hormone. But what it does do in humans is induce a particular kind of factor that has been associated with higher rates of heart disease and cancer in people. I hate saying that, because I just don't think the research is really in on it. And it's this nagging uncertainty about it that I think, from a health standpoint, makes me not want to give anything except organic milk to kids. And what I'm really happy to see is that lots of companies are saying they're not going to use milk that's been treated from cows that have been treated with cow growth hormone. And, you know, it's kind of disappearing.
I hope. Another thing on your book that really concerned me was the fact that while the somatotropin isn't identical to the human hormone, the insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1, in cows is identical. And that goes up as a result of the growth hormone being given to the cows, injected in the cows. You don't just change the rate of milk production, you change what's in the milk. And there's more IGF-1 in that milk. And that might, some of that might leak through, particularly if the person had an ulcer, if they had a impaired intestinal permeability. In other words, the sicker people, the older people, the ones who don't make enough gastric acids.
Or the younger people, young kids.
Yeah, or the very, very young, because we know babies have permeable guts. You know, that's why babies get food allergies so easily.
Well, what's so annoying about this is that it's so unnecessary. We never needed it in the first place. Actually, I once heard the head of Monsanto say that the reason that they invented bovine somatotropin was because they could. And they were eager to do something so that they could show that they could do something with genetic engineering that would affect food in some way. They never thought about the idea that people would be concerned that this was hard on the cows, or that people would be concerned about this insulin-like growth factor, or that, you know, we don't need more milk. We don't need cows to be producing that much more milk. We have plenty of milk.
Ethics is not a selective pressure that is acting on the actions of corporations.
Well, again, there's only one pressure acting on corporations, and that's Wall Street.
Right. Exactly my point. I want to talk about farmed salmon as well, because you taught me something, and I want to thank you and formally recognize that I knew, and my audience knew, about farmed salmon and the PCBs. And we knew about the potential for agricultural runoff and PCBs in the feed leading to increased PCBs in the farmed salmon. But what I didn't realize was that some of the dyes that are used to pink up the otherwise kind of gray, ucky-looking flesh of a farmed salmon might accumulate in the human body and represent another colossal uncontrolled experiment on the order of bisphenol A in the population.
Well, there it is. I mean, here's this dye, and you're eating it. I mean, I just think that eating these artificial colors is just never a good idea.
But nobody
will buy farmed salmon if it's gray.
No, and this cantha xanthin, C-A-N-T-H-A-X-A-N-T-H-I-N, cantha xanthin, actually accumulates in the retina.
Well, there's one study that shows that.
One study is good. I'm going to get nervous over one study.
Yeah, one study shows it, and there hasn't been anything since, so it's been 4 or 5 years since there's been much in the way of follow-up. I don't know what...
But has anybody tried to replicate that idea. And failed? Or has Guido taken them aside and told them they better not follow that line of research?
I have no idea. That's part of the problem with all of this, is that many of these factors that are in these foods are unresearched or under-researched. The food companies aren't going to be doing the research on this, and if you did, you wouldn't believe their results anyway. And the government doesn't sponsor very much of this kind of thing. The FDA used to do it, but was taken out of the research business.
Elaborate on that. The FDA was taken out of the research business.
Well, the FDA used to have an extraordinary research operation, and Congress decided that wasn't its function. Remember, the FDA is an agency. It does what Congress tells it to.
When did they make that decision, just out of curiosity?
Oh, I'll have to. I think it was in the late 90s. I mean, the Congress systematically took resources away from the FDA starting in the 1990s during the Bush administration, actually during the Clinton administration too. Congress got very angry with the FDA when FDA Commissioner David Kessler attempted to regulate tobacco as a drug and attempted to regulate dietary supplements. And they didn't like that. And so over a series of acts passed in the 1990s, Congress systematically weakened the FDA's ability to regulate the food supply and took resources away from it. And the result is an agency that's dysfunctionally weak. And only now, in this new administration, does there seem to be an attempt to try to put resources into the FDA and give the FDA the power that it needs to regulate the food supply in some reasonable way.
And hopefully keep us safe in an ever more complex supply web.
That would be nice.
In your book, Food Politics, you spend a long time talking about the food pyramid, and I wanted to be sure that we paid some attention to the old food pyramid, although I have to tell you, speaking as a physician and someone who thinks she knows something about nutrition, when that came out, I had a good long laugh, and I just saw all the dollar bills being brought into the senators' offices by the men in the three-piece suits. You tell the whole down and dirty story of the food pyramid.
The USDA.
USDA, which is obviously an agency whose purpose is to promote the interest of major food producers.
Yes, I mean, that's the USDA's function is to promote American agriculture. And only in the 1970s and 80s was it given increasing power to advise the public about diet and health, the fox watching the chickens, as it were. There never was any problem about dietary advice when the advice was to eat more. It was when the advice became, you know, you really ought to eat less, particularly of saturated fat, cholesterol, sugar, salt, and so forth, that it ran into trouble, because the foods that contain those nutrients are foods that are promoted as commodities by the Department of Agriculture, and American agriculture depends on them, or historically has depended on them. The Department of Agriculture views fruits and vegetables, historically has viewed them as specialty crops. I mean, they're not really considered anything that you take very seriously. So when the Department of Agriculture nutritionists came up with this idea of a pyramid in the early 1990s, and it was actually at the printer having its color checked and was about ready to be issued when the cattlemen were in Washington and found out that meat and dairy products were going to be at the top of the pyramid near the fats and oils and sugars, and that fruits and vegetables and grains would be at the bottom. They just lost it completely and complained to the Department of Agriculture, and there was a new Secretary of Agriculture who was unaware of the process that the nutrition people had gone through, which was 12 years of research. And so he withdrew it from the printers, said they were going to completely redo the research, that obviously a terrible mistake had been made. And then there was a year of politics during which every single newspaper and magazine in the United States wrote stories about conflicts of interest at the USDA. And eventually they published the pyramid with very few changes a year later. And they really couldn't get rid of it until 1995, after the 1995 dietary guidelines came out, when they were able to produce a sanitized version that doesn't even have any food on it. So there's no question about what the hierarchies of food are. And that's the one we're living with now. I think it's impossible to use. I don't know about you, whether you use it in your practice.
Oh, of course not.
I use the old one. With all its flaws, it was usable. This will change again in this administration, because there's a new dietary guidelines that is supposed to be released next year. And if there's a new dietary guidelines, there will need to be a revision of the pyramid to go along with it.
I am just struck with the image of a stampede of cattle, except they're humans wearing cowboy hats and cowboy boots, and they stampede through the doors of the U.S. Department of Agriculure and fill the corridors heading for the Secretary of Agriculture's office, making mooing noises.
They were very, very powerful in those days. They've sort of backed off a lot of that, mainly because they've won. The pyramid and the dietary guidelines all recommend meat, and they're actually recommending more meat now than they were years and years ago. So in a sense, they've won. They're busy now trying to oppose all of the efforts to try to get people to eat less meat, meatless Mondays, and that sort of thing, because of climate change and the contribution that raising cattle has to climate change. So that's their new battle.
It would be a wonderful dividend accruing to reframing our eating habits along the lines of something that might be more sustainable ecologically, because I'm feeling that it might also be a little more sustainable on a personal level.
I think so. The great part about it is that all of the dietary recommendations are the same. I mean, my recommendations are very simple. If you're worried about obesity, you eat less, move more, eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, and don't eat too much junk food. I mean, I just think dietary advice is as simple as that. If you're worried about overweight, it's mostly because you're taking in too many calories. Eat less. Mm-hmm. Not so easy to do, but in theory, very, very simple.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Marion Nestle, it's been a pleasure to interview you, and I will urge my audience to look for your books, Food Politics and What to Eat and Safe Food, because I think you bring a well-supported and even-handed perspective, which is very much appreciated.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.